So here's the reality, gang. The government is partially shut down still. And yes, an amazing political story. The economy, though, oh, it never sleeps. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 10th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You remember way back before the holidays, all those great retail forecasts we were getting? Consumer confidence was high, the economic numbers were good, sales were gonna be great. Turned out to be a bit of a mixed bag, actually. Some of the big retailers like Target and Costco have posted strong sales of late. Others, to wit, Macy's and JCPenney, well, they have struggled. Marketplace's Renata Sago gets us going with retail.
Target saw a 5.7% jump in online sales for most of November and all of December. The retailer is increasingly online focused, offering shoppers more options for how to buy and pick up stuff. Rod Seitz is with Deloitte. He says making things easier for consumers is one key to success these days.
Convenience has become the new currency of retail.
Target's digital push isn't just about shopping online. It's about making the store experience better, and that's helping drive sales, says Sucharita Kadali with Forrester Research. One example?
They have this tool which lets you get certain promotions in the physical store. And then the other is that they have a lot of location-specific information,
which lets consumers know which stores have certain products in stock. Another retailer finding success with its increasing focus on e-commerce is Walmart, which has posted a string of quarters with strong sales. Not doing so well in recent months? Some department stores like Macy's, which suffers from being located in many lower traffic shopping malls. David Silverman is with Fitch Ratings.
They may have two stores that are within a few miles of each other in centers that are nearby each other, occasionally over time where they've had two locations in one mall.
Macy's posted sales growth of just over 1% for the recent holiday period. At JCPenney, which you can also find in many a mall, sales fell 3.5% for the 9 weeks that ended January 5th. The lesson here? Invest in digital. Don't be in malls. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
We are going to go from mixed industry news, retail, to a straight-up gloomy industry story. The Ford Motor Company announced this morning it is going to transform its operations in Europe. That's their word, transform. And it was doing a lot of work in the press release today because plants are going to be closed, models are going to be discontinued, and what one company executive called a significant number of Ford's 50,000 European employees are going to lose their jobs. The news comes as the European economy has been showing some signs of slowing down, and consumer demand for cars pretty much everywhere is changing. Ford is the last American car maker with a big presence on the continent, but as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, Europe is an industry-wide problem.
Ford's been making cars in Europe for over a century, but executives say making money there has been difficult for decades. David Whiston at Morningstar says Ford is not alone. General Motors sold off its European brands in 2017.
One reason GM got off, for example, is because they hadn't made money since the late 90s there, and they finally gave up after the Brexit vote.
Brexit could make life more difficult for Ford, too. David Bailey at the Aston Business School in Birmingham, England, says if there's a hard Brexit,
there'll be a 10% tariff. That will make them more expensive. People are likely to switch to other brands.
Bailey says demand is soft on the continent, too. But Ford has its own structural problems.
We've seen a big contraction in what the Europeans would see as kind of small to medium-sized cars. And that's had a particular impact on Ford because that's where they were particular market leaders.
Lately, Europeans have started to favor SUVs and crossovers. You'd think those would be right in Ford's wheelhouse. But Carl Brower at Kelley Blue Book says European automakers have mastered their own style of bigger, boxier vehicles.
They became much more competitive with, you know, U.S. vehicles that were for sale over there that didn't have as much appeal.
Ford isn't leaving Europe completely. At the Detroit Auto Show next week, it's reportedly announcing a partnership with Volkswagen, Europe's number one automaker.
If they are able to come together and rebrand and slightly restyle some Volkswagen product that they sell as a Ford, it's a lot less expensive and it maintains their presence there.
Back in July, Ford announced an $11 billion plan to reshape its entire business. Brower says that means divisions and markets that are performing poorly, like Europe, are under the gun. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Jay Powell did an event today in New York, the Fed chair, and a lunchtime onstage conversation with billionaire David Rubenstein. He founded the Carlyle Group, where, as it happens, Powell once worked. just for the record. Rubenstein is also the president of the Economic Club of New York, which hosted the lunch. Anyway, one particular thing caught our ear, and literally this was in the first couple of minutes of Powell talking. See if you can tell what grabbed us.
The good thing is we're in a place where we can be patient. We have the ability to be patient and watch patiently and carefully. Second, as I mentioned, it gives us the opportunity to be patient and watch.
All right, so I shouldn't anticipate at your next FOMC meeting a big increase in interest rates.
You should anticipate that we're going to be patient and watching.
Okay, all right, well.
And waiting and seeing.
I mean, props to Rubenstein for asking the question, right? Powell, though, is nothing if not on message, making sure Wall Street knows he is listening. Speaking of which, Wall Street, that is, it's going to be the happy music when we get there. We are now on day 20 of the government shutdown. Tomorrow ties the record of 21. It's also going to be the first missed paycheck for hundreds of thousands of government workers. There are personal costs to all of this politicking, of course, but there are broader costs as well, especially when you consider all the essential employees, people who still have to go to work, paycheck or not. Yers Muris is an assistant professor of management and human resources at the University of Wisconsin School of Business, where he studies personal finances and those broader costs. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we know that losing your income can be stressful. The thing I wanted to touch base with you on is what happens when that stress affects your job. And I'm thinking now about some of the people who've been declared essential, working without pay, TSA, FBI, air traffic controllers. What happens to them as they try to perform at the high level that we expect?
In my research, I've consistently found that when employees are worried about their finances, it can undermine their ability to be productive at work. And this is not just how much they work or how much they're able to do, but also the quality of their work. And so what you find is that, for example, truck drivers are more likely to get accidents. Students do worse in the classroom. And so, you know, across all these jobs, what we found is that when people have this financial insecurity, it's going to affect them at work. And now you have federal workers who are deemed to be vital to national security, who are working without getting a paycheck, and who are also uncertain about their financial future. And so we would expect those same effects there, more errors and declining safety for all of us.
To be completely candid, I'm a reader of Jim Fallows' column, The Atlantic. He's a friend of the program, and we've had him on many times, and he's how we found you. And Jim is very aviation-focused, so let me keep going in that vein. Air traffic controllers. I saw a tweet today from a guy who's been an air traffic controller for 29 years, and just got a $0 pay stub. What does that do to you as you're driving planes around the sky or helping them get there?
At a very psychological level, what it does is that when people have financial issues or they have insecurity about their financial state, it tends to invoke anxiety, and that leads us to focus on it. And this for two reasons. One is because we just think about it more often, but also because we don't want to show it to people. And that suppression of what we're going through also focuses actually our attention on it. And so because we're so focused on it, we can't focus on our work throughout the day. And so if you have an air traffic controller who they didn't get their paycheck and now they're worried about their mortgage, well, they're not going to be as attentive to the things that we would want them to attend to and probably that they would want to attend to.
Yeah. Does this go away once, in our immediate example, the shutdown has ended? I mean, if the shutdown ends tomorrow, are we good?
The unfortunate answer is most likely no. So there's many reports that have shown that in the United States, their personal financial welfare is very, very poor. Most people don't have $400 in case of an emergency. Yeah. And so this government shutdown is just exacerbating that. And these effects of the shutdown on these people will last for a very, very long time. And so we should really be concerned about what's going on and thinking about ways to address those issues.
Dr. Urs Meurs teaches at the University of Wisconsin Business School, where he studies finance and society and people's finances. Sir, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Two data points now about the Chinese economy that might give one pause. First of all, the Apple news of last week, the shortfall in iPhone revenue entirely, said Apple CEO Tim Cook, due to China. And number two, Beijing just yesterday reporting the first drop in auto sales in 20 years. But look, there's data, and then there's what people are really doing, right? So our China correspondent Jennifer Pak went out onto the streets of Shanghai to get a sense of how Chinese consumers are actually feeling.
It's a gray and rainy day here in Shanghai, but that's not stopping shoppers from coming here to Nanjing Pedestrian Street. It's a very popular shopping area where you can get Gap. There's Etude House that sells Korean makeup, a Rolex shop, a Chinese pharmacy. With so many choices, what are people buying?
买什么东西呢?
Baby clothes, says Hu Yue and Wang Ying.
爸爸啊,
Xiao Zhenfang and his friends are shopping for handbags and jewelry for their wives while snacking on sticky rice desserts. But otherwise, Xiao Zhenfang says he's cutting back on spending.
The company I work for isn't doing well. It's a metal parts factory.
He says he hasn't received his salary for a few months, so he's canceled an annual visit to his home village for the upcoming Lunar New Year holiday. Down the street, loud music plays from clothing shops to attract customers like Zhou Zhihui, who spends his entire salary every month. So, has he felt the economic slowdown? No, he says. And many shoppers here tell me the same thing. That's partly because China's economy is still growing at a faster rate than the U.S. and Europe, says Louis Kaz of Oxford Economics.
People still can expect robust wage increases this year. And the bulk of people will not be at the risk that their job will disappear.
He says most families in China have seen their lives improve drastically for years. Take the Liu family. They're visiting from central China.
How do you do?
Liu Yongxian didn't grow up with a lot, but his two-year-old grandson is already learning English and drinking one of the most expensive brands of milk formula.
My grandson's milk powder is from Denmark. It cost about $60 per can.
But for himself, he's still saving everything he can, in case he gets sick. Because while China is a communist state with public health care, a serious illness can still bankrupt a family. Most people also save a lot for retirement, housing, and education for their children, which means in a weaker economy, some consumers cut back on the extras. That would be bad news for U.S. firms, but at least one American brand isn't afraid. Last month, Red Lobster opened its first branch in Greater China in Shanghai with the help of FWM Restaurant's David Martin.
We're not seeing it that people don't want to ever go out. We're seeing that when there's a celebration, they want to make sure they're making the right choice. They're choosing to go with brands because they're looking for security and they want to know that something's good.
Behind us, Melody Wong and Austin Chen have ordered lobster tacos, a pot of seafood, soup, salad, and a bottle of wine. They say this meal will cost them well over $100, which is normal for the couple. And consumers like them are driving much of the growth for American and global firms. A reminder that what people in China do and do not buy impacts the rest of the world. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think the minimum wage is going to keep on increasing, and we should try to keep it up with, you know, the cost of living.
Because living, you know, can be costly. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 122 points today, 0.5% for the blue chips, 24,001. NASDAQ, 28 points to the good, 0.4%, 69.86. The S&P 500 found 11 points, 0.4%, 25.95. As we mentioned, not all retail had a happy holiday, in particular Macy's, which announced it didn't sell as much as anticipated. Macy's shares tarnished more than 17% today. That helped push a couple of other retailers down as well. Kohl's and JCPenney both discounted more than 4%. Even Target, which as Renato was telling us, had strong holiday sales results, off 0.2%. Today, talked about Ford Motor Company in Europe. Ford sputtered more than 0.5% today. General Motors down 1.25%. The German automaker Volkswagen downshifted 1% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The New York Stock Exchange, you know. The NASDAQ, you know. There's the American Stock Exchange. You may or may not know that one. A bunch of others as well. It's a list to which we might soon be adding. A group of nine big finance companies, Morgan Stanley, Fidelity, also Charles Schwab, announced this week they're going to start up a new stock exchange, the Members Exchange. It's going to be called MEMEX for short. Alexander Osipovich covers exchanges for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why do these companies feel like they need another exchange? I mean, it's not like we don't have a bunch already.
Well, we do have a bunch of exchanges, but they're owned essentially almost entirely by three big companies. And the three big companies have become, in the views of many of their customers, kind of an oligopoly.
Hmm.
They are charging a lot of money to trade, and their customers have gotten ticked off about that.
Back me up for a minute here. You got to pay money to trade? I mean, I know that sounds like a ridiculous question, but I don't think a lot of people understand that exchanges themselves are businesses.
Yes. So exchanges now in the U.S. are all for-profit businesses. They collect a small fee every time stocks are traded on the exchange. On top of that, they've found other various fees they can charge, in particular for market data. Basically, if you're a big trader, you need to have a live feed of all the prices of what stocks are trading at on exchange at any given time. And that costs a lot of money, and it's increased a lot over the past few years.
And so that data is their commodity. It's their thing, right?
Yeah. And while the actual transaction fees have been kept in check by regulation,
right,
the data fees have been going up a lot. And it's not just data fees, but also the cost of having a high-speed connection in the data center. Essentially, being able to plug in your cable into the exchange's systems costs a lot of money.
Right. Okay. So how is this new members exchange going to be different?
So the members exchange is harking back to an old idea, which is the member-owned exchange. Basically, in the old days, the exchange was controlled by its members. So basically, the brokers and traders who are allowed to trade on the exchange own the exchange. And they set the rules for the exchange. And they set the fees.
So that's back in the day when you used to have like a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, right?
Exactly.
Right.
It was the seat holders, is another way of putting it. So they essentially ran the exchange in their interest. And there were some problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, starting in roughly the 1990s, the exchanges, as they said, demutualized. So they became private, for-profit companies. Eventually, they IPO'd.
Right.
Then they began to be owned by exchange companies. And the exchange companies have to make a profit. So they charge more fees to their customers. And since the customers used to own it, some of the customers got kind of ticked off about this after a while.
Right. So the members exchange will go back to that older model, I suppose. But then, you know, who's keeping an eye on them? And how do we know that it's all on the up and up? I mean, there is a transparency issue here, right?
Yeah. Well, the exchange business in general is very tightly regulated by the SEC. Everything an exchange does, it has to be approved by the SEC. And so it is pretty strictly overseen. The first hurdle for the members exchange will be to simply get approved as an exchange by the SEC. They have to put an application, which they say they're going to do early this year. And it often takes up to a year to get approval for that. Hmm. And it's a long and excruciating process because other people can weigh in and criticize your model. So there might be a big regulatory fight over whether MEMEX can even become an exchange, for starters.
Alex, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Alexander Osipovich there. He covers exchanges for the Wall Street Journal. Speaking of exchanges, by the way, coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, you're going to want to pay attention to airline stocks 2019. Not looking all that good. According to the National Consortium of State Legislatures, 8 states raised their minimum wages on January 1st because of laws tying minimum wages to the Consumer Price Index. The official policy language for that linkage is that the minimum wage is indexed to inflation. And among the states that do it is Ohio, home to the Marketplace Hub at WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, whence Adrian Ma reports that indexing, like the economy itself, has some ups and downs.
Any cookies, chips, or drinks for you today?
It's just after 3 o'clock, and Fantasia Pettis is wrapping up her shift at a Subway sandwich shop in downtown Cleveland.
Thank you. Have a good one.
She clocks out, takes some change from the tip jar,
all right, see you,
and heads out the door.
I mean, I love my job because I love the people that I work with. They make it really easy.
Pettis makes Ohio's minimum wage, now $8.55 an hour. And although it was raised automatically by 25 cents last week, she says,
I feel like it's still not enough. Just because it went up a quarter, I mean, you could find a quarter on the, walking down the street.
We do some quick math and find the raise comes to about 43 extra bucks a month before taxes. Is $43, what does that mean to you?
A phone bill.
When I ask Pettis whether she feels like she's getting by, she shrugs and says, barely.
Minimum wage, really, it's a struggle.
Not only does she have trouble meeting basic expenses, but according to the Consumer Price Index, those basics are getting more expensive, about 2% higher than last year. Ben Zipper with the Progressive Economic Policy Institute says that's where indexing comes in handy.
So, you know, if the cost of groceries, gasoline, housing goes up by X percent in Ohio, the minimum wage that following year is going to go up by the same percent.
Unlike the federal minimum wage, which has been stuck at $7.25 for years.
Tying these increases so that there's some kind of automatic process makes them much more predictable, makes them much easier to plan around.
Not just for workers, he says, but also for employers.
I think the minimum wage is going to keep on increasing, and we should try to keep it up with, you know, the cost of living.
That's Alex Gleason. He manages a neighborhoody joint called the Old Angle Tavern. He says his employees actually get more than Ohio's minimum wage. So if the floor only increases a couple percent every year, it'll be a while before his business feels any pressure. He says what really concerns him is talk of a $15 minimum wage.
It's a very low profit margin business, so that would be a big deal for businesses that are barely getting by.
And Aparna Mater with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute says a wage hike that large could also hurt employees.
Because you could find that those same employers are now less likely to hire new minimum wage workers, or they're less likely to keep existing workers on the job.
Or employers might replace those workers with machines. Now, all that said, if inflation stays relatively low, 2-3%, Mater says
employers can offset some of those hikes by passing on the cost to consumers. You know, the employment effects are likely to be minimal.
The benefit of an automatic increase, says Zipper from the Economic Policy Institute, is that when the cost of living goes up, so will the minimum wage. But what if that's still not enough?
Well, if you don't raise the minimum wage to an appropriate level to begin with, indexing kind of locks it into that level.
According to MIT's living wage calculator, a single adult in Ohio needs to earn about $10.47 an hour to stay just above the poverty line. The state's current minimum wage is now nearly $2 short of that. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, another quick bit from the Jay Powell Luncheon, David Rubenstein asking the questions.
If people want to come see you, let's suppose bankers want to see you, community bankers, what's the best way to get a meeting with you?
So I'm very easy to find. People can find me quite easily by calling the Fed, and you'll get put through to public affairs or even to my office.
202-452, you can Google it yourself. But can you imagine Alan Greenspan doing that, by the way? All right, we're out of here on shutdown day 20. Here's where things stand. Dow Industrial's up 122 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500, 11 points higher, 0.4% there as well. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.